In February 1946, not long after the war was won, Britain was once again under threat. For the previous 30 years, Jewish insurgents, dedicated to creating their own homeland in Palestine, had been fighting the British enforced mandate there. Now they were bringing their battle to London. Some of the nation's most powerful men were in their sights. And according to this previously top secret document, Whitehall, behind me here, was worried.
Top secret and personal. Memorandum. From Administering Government of Palestine to the Secretary of State for the Colonies. Members of the Stern Group are now being organised and are under training, and it is expected that they will be sent to the United Kingdom to assassinate important members of His Majesty's government, particularly Mr. Bevan. Other personages in the United Kingdom will also be assassinated.
One factor in particular fuelled anger against Britain and its Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevan. It was that before the general election of 1945, the Labour Party had intimated that it backed the creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. But after gaining office, it shelved the idea. Soon after the war ended, Bevan made this speech to the United Nations.
My government thinks it necessary to await the committee's report before putting forward any proposals relating to the future of Palestine.
In response, extremist groups like the Stern Gang and Irgun stepped up their campaign of violent revolt. In the months that followed, nearly 500 British servicemen and women were to die as a result. But the insurgents also suffered big losses, with hundreds of their fighters shot, jailed or hanged. With no breakthrough in sight, our documents show that a new front was opened up in Britain itself. It took the form of secret assassination squads.
Top secret. Stop. O. Stop F85-221, 27th of August, 1946. A further report received today from our Jerusalem representative states that Ergun and Stern have decided to send 5 cells to London to operate in a manner similar to the IRA.
Our documents also show that other Jewish targets included East London's Rotherhithe Tunnel, various military bases and some of the army's top brass. But the prime objective was the British Minister for Foreign Affairs, Ernest Bevan.
We all saw him. He was sitting on the back seat of the Humber. By the side of the driver there was a bodyguard. The bodyguard got out and opened the door for Bevan, whom he helped out. This was important. It showed that the back door was not locked on the inside, and that we should not be obliged to fire through windows, which might turn out to be bulletproof. The next day we kept watch again. The Humber went by at 8:45. My plan was made.
This version of events was taken from the book Memoirs of an Assassin by an Israeli man called Avner, who claimed to have been a member of a Stern Gang assassination squad. His account has never been verified, but our newly released documents suggest that a mission to kill Bevan did exist. But who exactly were the Stern Gang, and what plans did they have for Britain's foreign minister? The gang's political and spiritual home is Tel Aviv, where my investigation begins. This song, playing on the PA system of the Lehi or Stern Gang Museum, located in a narrow back street of Tel Aviv, was written by the group's founder, Yair Stern. He set up the movement after becoming convinced that the Irgun, a resistance group he had belonged to, wasn't being ruthless enough in its efforts to force the British to leave Palestine. Stern's song, The Unnamed Soldiers, which later became an anthem for Zionist resistance, encourages his followers to sacrifice their lives in pursuit of their Jewish homeland.
Here we are in the museum, pictures everywhere of founders of the Lehi.
This is Yair.
And there is the founder up on the wall there.
Yeah. Avraham Stern. Yair.
And he was killed in, was it?
In this building, on the roof.
3 rounds were fired from the guns of the British secret police. The point-blank shots, one aimed to the neck and the other two to the chest, snuffed the life of the thin man, who sat handcuffed looking into the gun barrels. Avraham Stern, known as Yair, had been murdered.
All around are pictures of the men and women who the British call terrorists and their Jewish supporters freedom fighters. The tools of their gruesome business are prize exhibits.
We can see here, what, about 8 or 9 guns? Yeah. All inside one suitcase, hidden presumably in a false bottom and a false top. And these are the actual weapons that would have been used by Stern in those days.
Yeah.
Death did not take away his place at the head of their columns. He marched at the front line of every battle until the British were expelled from our homeland.
Today, Stern and his followers, who had no qualms about killing for their cause, remain heroes to many. But so far I've found no evidence that they were prepared to take their war to Britain itself. To do that, I'm going to need to travel to Jerusalem to meet a man who was once a dedicated Stern Gang member.
On the 22nd of July 1946, the King David Hotel behind me here in Jerusalem was ripped apart by a huge explosion. The bomb, planted by Israeli extremists, killed 91 people and injured many, many more. 60 years on, I'm about to meet a man who was a member at the time of one of the groups that carried out that attack. But Ezra Yekin isn't meeting me to go over all that. Far from it, in fact. He's still bitter about another violent event, which he insists British officers were responsible for, but were never punished.
The brutal British crackdown had led to the death of Yair Stern. It had also netted more than 400 of his followers and those of Lehi. Much of the work was done by two crack SAS-style snatch squads, commissioned by Ernest Bevin. Like the insurgents they fought, these squads didn't always play by the rules. In one now notorious case, early in 1947, a 16-year-old Stern Gang member vanished after being taken for questioning by a Captain Roy Farron. Alexander Rubovitz was never seen again. Rumours abounded that he'd been tortured and killed. Farron, who was one of Britain's most decorated World War II heroes, fled to Syria, but was later arrested and charged with murder. But no body was found, and the case against him was later dropped due to a lack of evidence. This was how the Times reported the event.
Captain Roy Alexander Farron, a regular officer of the 3rd King's Own Hussars, was found not guilty by a court-martial today on the charge of murdering Alexander Rubovitz, the young Jew who has been missing since the night of May 6th to 7th. When the president of the court pronounced the verdict after an absence of 15 minutes, police members of Captain Farron's former squad, and also some military men sitting in the court as spectators, applauded.
The episode caused outrage in Palestine and left Stern Gang members bitter and more determined than ever to drive out the British. Ezra Yekim, Rubovitz's best friend at the time, is still convinced that Farron not only murdered the teenager, but cruelly mistreated him as well, in an effort to make him talk.
It's obvious that he's been tortured to death.
Why was that obvious?
We don't really know where he's buried. But there must be a good reason why they did not even try to show his body. It must be that they didn't want people to see the signs of torture. This can be the only reason.
What evidence is there that Roy Farron was responsible for his death? Because that's what people say here, that it was him.
When he was in Syria, he told them, please don't send me back to Palestine because I killed a Jewish terrorist and the Stern Gang is after me.
And you're in no doubt at all that it was him that killed Alexander?
Yes, there's no doubt.
A trawl through some old newspaper cuttings from the time shows that retaliation from Stern Gang members sent to Britain was swift, brutal, and tragically botched.
Bomb parcel for Captain Farron, brother killed by explosion. Mr. Rex Francis Farron, 26, brother of Captain Roy Farron, was killed this morning when he opened a parcel addressed to his brother at their home, Histon's Hill, Codsall.
In the meantime, one question concerns me. Is it fair to accuse Bevan and his government colleagues of deliberately thwarting the Jewish dream of a longed-for homeland? A Labour Party member at the time, Tony Benn, was also in Palestine in 1945. He rejects the suggestion that the Labour Party was, in any way, unsympathetic to the Jewish cause.
The Labour Party was committed to the establishment of a Jewish state. But a Jewish state is one thing, but of course, for the Jews to take over the whole of Palestine was another, and on the whole, the Zionists wanted to take over the whole of Palestine, and there was this continual conflict. And, of course, terrorism was one of the major instruments that the Zionists used. Because the one thing nobody really likes to admit, but it is true, assassination is an instrument of government policy all over the place. I mean, we tried to murder Nasser in 56. So it doesn't surprise me a bit that the Ernie Bevin as Foreign Secretary.
Date on this document. I forward the following report from the Inspector General of Police. A source whose information...
I've taken my file full of documents to Dr. Georgina Sinclair at the University of Leeds.
...the assassination of prominent persons in Cairo and the United Kingdom.
How seriously does she take this new evidence that Jewish assassination squads were roaming post-war Britain with ministers like Ernest Bevin on their hit list?
I'm not surprised by a plot to kill Bevin. It's not so far-fetched as it would seem. Palestine suffers serious civil unrest from the 1920s really onwards, particularly during the 1930s with the Great Arab Revolt. We have to think that there is a divided community of sorts, if you like, with problems intensifying, yeah, between both factions. This encouraged young people to join Irgun or Stern. So definitely from about 1944, Irgun and Stern are stepping up their activities.
I've now discovered that Roy Farron is still alive and living in Canada.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Is Roy Farron there, please? So, was Farron the nemesis of the Stern gang whose actions had placed him and Bevan at the top of their hit list really a murderer?
He's still sleeping, though. What's going on?
I finally got lucky in tracing Mr. Farron. The phone number I've got is correct, but I've been told to call back later.
Yeah. Shall I give a call in a couple of hours' time?
Since that phone call, I've tried several times to speak to Roy Farron on the same phone number. Now I know I never will. I've just heard that he's died from old age. He was 85. But even without Farron's testimony, I do know that it was largely his success in rounding up Stern Gang and Irgun members that triggered their decision to send assassination squads to Britain. And over the last few days, contacts I've made in Tel Aviv have revealed the identity of the Stern Gang member who was sent to Britain to kill Farron back in 1946. His name is Yaakov Haruti. Could the man who I'm told is alive and living in Tel Aviv also be the assassin who was sent to kill Bevan? Finding Mr. Haruti is now becoming one of my top priorities. Ya bahar yoked ani hulemet verot ana. This song, still popular in Israel today, describes a young girl picking poppies in her Jewish homeland. The poppies are a metaphor for the red caps worn by the British soldiers serving in Palestine and the bloody sacrifices the people made to drive them out, which were now stepping up a gear.
Secret telegram for dispatch in cipher. Stop. O stop F606-1. 21st of the 3rd, 1946. The Home Office is paying close attention to renewed reports to Stern activity in UK and has asked us to endeavour to tighten existing security arrangements.
I've now come to New Milton in Hampshire. And I'm trying to find Edward Horn, who was a policeman in Palestine at the time. And I'm told he lives in one of these rows of red brick buildings. And I believe this might be Mrs. Horn.
Yes, I am.
Edward Horn was in charge of a CID unit in Palestine until 1946. On returning home, he joined London's Metropolitan Police and continued to be involved in Jewish affairs. What I'm hoping is that he can tell me how much support Stern Gang squads in the capital got from the local Jewish community.
I did come across several Jewish people. They admitted they were supporters of either Lehi or the Irgun. I don't want to give their names, but one I came across, he was in business in Bond Street. He was a Lehi supporter and had a picture of Shamir above his head. Another was in Regent Street. He openly boasted of his connection with Irgun. Another had a cafe in Willesden Green, and he would like to have stayed in Palestine, but his wife couldn't stand the climate.
And it seems that Stern or Lehi squads had established bases across Europe, which they used to help mount a number of attacks on British targets. Mr. Horn remembers one of the most audacious, a plan to bomb the House of Commons using an aeroplane flown from France.
After I got home, MI6 had warned the French police. The French police found two men who were Lehi supporters. They'd acquired an aeroplane and planned to fly the channel and drop a token bomb over the House of Commons. And this was stopped. It would have done some damage if it had gone off. It was about the time that the Colonial Office received a bomb, and the British Embassy in Rome received one of the first letter bombs.
Reading through newspaper cuttings from the time, it's clear that bombs were indeed detonated in Britain by Jewish terrorists. One was sent to the home of Sir Evelyn Barker, former commanding officer in Palestine. His wife became suspicious and the device was defused. One bomb exploded in the British Colonial Office in London. Another letter bomb sent from a post office here in Marble Arch killed Roy Farron's brother. But what about Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin? What plans did our Jewish assassins have for him?
9th of November 1946. OF-608-1. Top Secret. Dear Trafford Smith, latest reports indicate somewhat increased probability Jewish terrorists may attempt outrage in UK. The Rome Embassy episode would support this possibility.
We're now on our way through the Tel Aviv traffic to meet Semrul Katz, who was Irgun's representative in Britain. So I'd imagine he'll be able to tell me pretty much all there is to know about what Irgun was doing in Britain during that time.
Samuel Katz was born in South Africa, later ending up in Palestine, where he became a member of Irgun, the insurgent group that spawned the Stern Gang. Just 3 months after the King David Hotel bombing, he was part of the mission which attacked the British Embassy in Rome. After Rome, he was sent to Britain. Why?
The next mission I had in Britain was to see how the explosion in Rome had affected the British public. And this was, I think, one of the greatest victories that the Irgun achieved, because the press, they immediately announced and established the fact that the Irgun was now going to attack Britain physically.
The Times, Friday, November the 1st, 1946. Bomb outrage in Rome, British Embassy damaged. Soon after 2:30 this morning, a severe explosion from two bombs seriously damaged the British Embassy.
I remember travelling along Oxford Road, and the poster said, Irgun attacks Britain. The papers talked about Irgun agents in Britain. And so the CID closed its offices for the day. They didn't exist at night. And the Queen was given extra security measures.
Was that good for your cause or bad for your cause?
It was very good for our cause. It was very good for our cause, because it suggested that we were very serious people.
But Katz insists that his members did try to live up to their increasingly menacing image in the British press. Amongst their intended targets for assassination in London was, once again, General Barker, former commanding officer in Palestine.
One of the boys who had blown up the embassy in Rome, he and a girl settled themselves where General Barker was, with the idea of shooting him, because we regarded him as a first-class bastard and an anti-Semite. And they sat there for several days. They never saw General Barker. Barker was very, very careful. He didn't go down the street without half a dozen bodyguards. So that he wasn't a very brave man, apparently.
Now, I have here a document dated July 1948, and it's from the Chief Inspector of Special Branch, Mr. E.W. Jones. And he says, "We learn from a source of unknown reliability that a member of the Stern gang succeeded in entering this country through the port of Harwich with some Luger pistols."
There actually was a plan to assassinate Bevin. I was told that the person who was supposed to do it had been within short range of Bevin at some event, but for some reason got cold feet and didn't do the job.
Katz could only confirm that there was a plot to kill Bevin. He could tell me no more than that. But he did agree to direct me to a former Stern gang member, also living in Tel Aviv, who knows a whole lot more.
So far, I've not got much further on verifying claims that Jewish extremists planned to assassinate Britain's Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin in London soon after the war. But I'm now travelling across Tel Aviv to talk to a man who I'm told knew all about that plot and even supplied the explosives to carry it out. Thank you very much.
In a small apartment, commanding panoramic views for more than 15 miles along Israel's golden sand coastline, lives Benjamin Gepner. Now in his 90s, Gepner won medals for fighting the Nazis after joining the British Army. But when that fight was over, he returned to Palestine to wage war on his former comrades as a fighter for Stern. He was soon to become the group's head of operations in the USA, from where he organised the acquisition and dispatch of explosives for use in Stern gang bombing campaigns. One of these, he tells me, was the aerial bomb attack on the House of Commons.
There was a Jewish man who was very popular in America. He was called Rabbi Korf, K-O-R-W. He helped us. He called me one day and he said, "I'm going to France. What will you do in France?" He didn't say, tell me. I said, "Well, what hotel will you be in?" He told me what hotel, Carillon. I remember Carillon. So I immediately notified our men in France, Korf will be in Carillon and so on. So they contacted him and he told them, "Look, I am ready to finance a plane that will throw a bomb and throw it on land."
But what about the plot to kill Britain's Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin? Was Gepner involved in that as well?
Well, I was notified that our people in England needed explosives. I sent them in a radio set. I sent them the explosives.
What operation were those explosives destined for?
I thought Bevin.
Gepner confirms that Yaakov Haruti, the man I've been trying to trace in Tel Aviv, was the man sent to kill Bevin in London, and the one responsible for sending the parcel bomb that was supposed to kill Captain Roy Farron, but inadvertently killed his brother Rex instead.
We deeply deplored the death of his brother. His brother was an innocent man, and it was terrible thing that happened that he had opened the book which was intended for his brother.
Because he had the same initial, didn't he?
Yes. I spoke to Haruti. The name and the forename were explicit. Of course, it was the same address, but...
And yet he opened it.
Yeah, he opened it. He wasn't supposed to look what his brother has got.
At last, I'm closing in on Haruti, the man behind both the Bevin and Farron assassination plots. I get a phone number for him, and he agrees to talk to me. Frustratingly, a few days later, he suddenly backs out, even though he confirmed that he had been in England and he had received explosives from the United States. He's also confirmed his part in the bungled killing of Rex Farron and that he was planning to kill Bevin. But after protracted negotiations, he does agree to give me a written statement.
The atmosphere in England today is unfortunately, and for no good reasons, anti-Israeli. I do not think there is a fair chance of an objective public discussion of the 1948 War of Israeli Independence. In 1948, there was a war between the British government and the Jewish people trying to liberate their homeland. The Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, Lehi, of which I was a member, was the smallest of the three organizations participating in the war. As of 1946 until 1948, there were attempts to operate in England. And by the end of the war, there were small groups of Lehi and Irgun operating in England. Terrorizing civilians was never even considered. As of May 15, 1948, all activities in England were frozen. As of September 1949, Lehi ceased to exist.
Hello, BBC. This is Richard Williams calling from Jerusalem on the last day of the British Mandate. I'm standing in front of the King David Hotel. In a few minutes, officials of the Palestine government will leave the building for the last time, and the Union Jack, now flying on the mast, will be hauled down and the flag of the International Red Cross will be run up in its place.
Finally, in June 1948, Britain pulled out of Palestine, and the Stern Gang's long-cherished homeland was born after a long and bloody campaign.
Well, I have to say, what a fantastic view from your window here.
Back at his seaside apartment in Tel Aviv, Benjamin Gepner refuses to apologise for his role in the insurgency of 60 years ago, making it ever more clear that had Britain not declared its intentions to leave Palestine in 1948, the attempt on the life of Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin would have gone ahead as planned. And, had this proved successful, no tears would be shed, even all these years later, by those responsible.
Look, you can't be a freedom fighter without fighting. And you cannot fight without occasionally killing someone. This is either you go in or you're out outside. There is no halfways there. And we were determined to go on. If the Britons hadn't left Palestine, we would make more miserable for them their life because we were developing, we are gaining ground more and more.
Thank you.